So basically, I'm gonna first motivate you on why are we doing this kind of research of looking for witnesses of strong non-classicality. Then I'm gonna introduce you to causal inference. That's the framework that we use. And then I'm gonna talk a little bit about the actual research that we did in this winter school. Right, so first for motivation. When you guys think about quantum mechanics, like from what you learned in undergrad or something, there are some words and some phenomena that pop up in mind. Some of them could be like superposition, like that is related to some phenomena like the double slit experiment or the Max Zender interferometer. Some of them could be also non-commutativity of measurements, uncertainty principle, entanglement. These are all things that kind of like, if people ask us, what is quantum mechanics about? How is it different from classical mechanics? These are things that come to mind. If you go a bit further, like in quantum information, there are also more things like and the existence of a no-cloning theorem, of a no-broadcasting, monogamy of pure entanglement, the existence of a teleportation protocol. All those things, they come up as intrinsically quantum properties, but actually they are not. They are all reproducible in a classically simulable model called Bekenstein theory. Here I write classically simulable because I don't want to get into the details of what I mean by classical. But you can imagine that it's easy to simulate that in a classical computer. So if we want to find out what is the true origin of quantum advantage, for example, it's not just in those things. If you're curious about this, you can take a look at those references. But this theory basically does that by using a restriction that in our knowledge about the system. All right, so these things don't represent what is quintessentially quantum. So what does? We need some stronger notion of non-classicality, right? One of them is Bell non-locality. I'm going to talk a little bit about Bell's theorem because maybe not everybody is acquainted with it. So imagine that your setup is you have two labs, Alice and Bob, and each one of them has two choices of measurement. So suppose that S and T are bits that represent, for example, I'm going to measure X or I'm going to measure Z. So it's the choice of basis of measurement. And A and B are also bits that represent the outcome. So the measurements we're talking about in this BLCHSH scenario, they only have two possible outcomes. And furthermore, Alice and Bob, they share some system. And initially, we're going to consider that it's a classical system that they share, like a classical hidden variable. Now I'm going to explain to you what are the hypotheses of Bell's theorem. The first one is that you can make this experiment in a space-time structure like this. And what this would mean if you assume that special relativity is correct. First, this would mean that T cannot signal to A, right? Because it's outside the light cone. So I'm going to represent those kind of things with this symbol. Or perpendicular, when I mean that one variable is independent of the other, given another variable. This thing here is like conditioning that I know the value of another variable. And the analogous is true on the other side. So these two conditions are called local causality. This is the first hypothesis. The second one is that Alice and Bob are there free to choose S and T. So Alice and Bob, they can choose like whether they're going to perform the X or Z basis of measurements, for example, in a free way without being influenced by lambda. So lambda only influences directly A and B, does not influence S and T. This is called free will or no superdeterminism. And here I'm going to represent it the same way. S is independent of T and lambda. Right. Now, from this hypothesis, Bell's theorem is basically saying that if you assume that lambda is a what he called hidden variable or like a classical random variable, you derive this inequality. And these are Bell's inequalities that are valid every time your theory is like a classical hidden variables theory. But what's important here is that reality and quantum mechanics are not like that. You can find a quantum state that, like, if you switch lambda from being instead of a classical system being a quantum system, then you can violate this inequality. All right, now I'm gonna change topics a little bit and talk about causal inference. That's our framework, and I'm going to come back to this soon. So first, imagine that you have a very high correlation between two things. Suppose that every time you see that in a certain city, the sunburn hospitalizations go up, the ice cream sales also go up. Like a very silly example. Does this mean that ice cream causes sunburn? Or maybe that being sunburned makes you want to eat ice cream? No, because correlation does not imply causation, right? What happens here is that we had a hidden common cause, hidden in the sense that in that graph, we weren't considering the heat. But if you really want to know what is the causal structure that is explaining your data, you need to consider it. And the important thing in this causal structure is that if you know exactly what is the temperature, or like the sunniness or something, the sunburn hospitalizations and the ice cream sales become independent. And we represent that in the same notation as before, like this. S is independent of I, given that you know what is H. This is the type of constraint of causal structures that allows you to relate a causal structure to a probability distribution. So what we observe in the lab is not like, it's just probability distributions, like just correlations. And then the goal of causal inference is trying to explain those correlations, trying to see which causal structures are possible candidates for explaining those correlations, or which are like not possible at all. And how would you know that? Here, for example, what are the constraints that this causal structure gives? It's just the constraint I wrote, but in terms of probability distributions, it just means that if we could measure H, the joint probability distribution of those three things should factorize like that. Like, given that it's conditional on H here, it factorizes. So we had this restriction on which probability distributions could be compatible with this causal explanation. All right. We could also have some other variables that influence in our experiment, right? For example, the sun protection awareness of the population of that city. It obviously only influences us and not the other two things. But imagine that this is very hard to measure. Like, and then the experimenter chooses not to measure this during this experiment. If the experimenter chooses not to measure it, or if it is in principle not able to measure it, we are going to call it a latent variable or like a hidden variable, and we're going to represent it in red in our causal structures. So just a change of notation. This is just the same causal structure, but now with the same type of drawing that I'm going to use in the rest of the talk. And this is the structure that we use in causal inference, and it's called a DAG, a directed acyclic graph. It's directed because the directed arrows mean direct causation between one thing and the other. And it's acyclic because like that guarantees us that we're not going to get into grandfather paradoxes, for example. That is when you go back in time and kill your grandfather or something like that. Okay, so what can we do with that? Causal inference has a lot of applications in a lot of different areas. Actually, here I just put three, but that's because this slide is from last year when like COVID was a big thing. So yeah. And then also in medicine and also in other, like a lot of different things. This area was actually not born in physics, it was born in machine learning. And then, but why is it important to physicists? I'm going to go back to the Bell scenario now that I was talking about before. So if you assume, for example, local causality that I was talking to you guys about, that you can make the experiments in space like separated points, this is the causal structure that represents that experiment, where S and T are the measurement choices of Alice and Bob, A and B are the measurement outcomes, and lambda is the shared system. Right now, I'm going to represent by red all the latent nodes that are classical system. So here, everything is a classical random variable, nothing is quantum yet. And as I mentioned to you before, what relates causal structures to probability distributions is those set of causal constraints that we get. And the causal constraints that we get for this graph are these ones. And they are exactly local causality, no superdeterminism, and Bell's inequality. And what's interesting is that if you switch the variable lambda from a classical variable, classical random variable, to a quantum system, now you can violate that inequality. Like if you switch like the definition of how nodes depends on their parents inside a causality graph, but you still keep the causal structure like this, then the two first constraints are kept because like the hypothesis of the theorem still hold, but the inequality can be violated. And this is a way of rephrasing Bell's theorem in causal terms. That's something very neat. So I'm going to represent, like, in other words, what a quantum classical gap means is that the set of probability distributions that are quantumly compatible with the graph is strictly larger than the set of probability distributions that are classically compatible with the graph. Since a graph can only have equality or inequality type constraints, and it is proven that the equality types also hold in the quantum case, you having this gap is equivalent to saying that the inequalities are quantumly violated. So the constraints that you violate are the inequalities. All right, so I showed you the Bell graph, but there are actually other causal structures that also have quantum classical gaps. And here I put two examples, the instrumental scenario and the triangle scenario. These ones were already known. And even the instrumental scenario was actually already experimentally tested as well, as well as Bell experiment was already tested multiple times, as you may know. So this is the goal of our project. The goal of our project is finding more causal structures like these ones that are different from Bell, but that also present a quantum classical gap. And this might be interesting because first, it might teach us something about quantum theory, like it might even maybe lead us to new no-go theorems like Bell's or something like that. And it might also give us new resources because we believe this is like an example of where true quintessentially non-classicality comes from. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about what we actually did in the winter school. The idea like of what we got was, instead of like having like really new techniques like Bell did to prove it, the first classical gap, we start from a DAG. A DAG is a directed acyclic graph, remember. So we start from a DAG where we know there is a quantum classical gap, let's say Bell or instrumental or one of the ones already known. And we do a transformation that does not reduce the gap. So it's a QC gap non-decreasing transformation. As you can see, like the hard part, like this QC gap non-decreasing transformation is what we're going to call the trick. The hard part is proving that it really does not decrease the quantum classical gap. And then if we get to something else that originally we didn't know whether you had a gap or not, if we could get through this QC gap non-decreasing transformation, that means that yes, the new gap tag also has a quantum classical gap. This is the idea, but what we do in real life is the opposite. We start from a DAG where we don't know if it has a quantum classical gap or not. Then we make a transformation that we previously proven, that it does not increase the quantum classical gap. And then you get something where we know there is a quantum classical gap. Then we can infer that the original one also has a QC gap. So I'm going to give you an example. The example is this causal structure. Originally, we didn't know if it had a QC gap or not. Like we didn't know if, for example, if we take lambda and alpha go quantum, does this change anything on the set of probability distributions that is compatible with it or not? So this is why here I put dashed lines and a question mark. And the idea is doing this transformation and going to somewhere, some DAG that we know has a QC gap. The transformation that we used here was marginalizing out one node. By marginalizing out, I mean literally you have the probability distributions of X, A, C, B, and then I'm going to marginalize out C, so I'm going to sum over all possibilities of C. Marginalizing out one node is the same as the node being latent, as it being unobserved, because now you don't know anymore what is its value. So here I'm going to switch the color of C from blue to red, because now it's latent. And then what we use now was some techniques that were already known from classical causal inference that there are some rules that show when two DAGs are observationally equivalent, classically, meaning that the set of probability distributions that is compatible with one of them is exactly the same set of probability distributions that is compatible with the other. And then using one of those observational equivalence rules, we could prove that this one here above is observationally equivalent to that one. But that one is the instrumental scenario that I showed you before. That was also already experimentally tested, et cetera. So here it's a DAG where we know there is a quantum classical gap. However, this observational equivalence here, in principle, the rule that we used is only valid classically. So what we did was there was some inequality here in the DAG G prime, that is the instrumental. And we show that every inequality involving the probability distributions of G prime corresponds to an inequality involving the marginalization over G over C in that DAG G. However, we still didn't show that this inequality can be quantumly violated. Like here in this DAG, it can. If lambda goes quantum, then you can quantum violate it. You know it. But here, maybe it doesn't, because this step here was only valid classically. So we still have some work to do. So basically, just recapitulating what we did was we still don't know anything about the quantum set of this DAG, but now we know a little bit about the classical set. Like, we don't know everything as well, but we know at least that it has some inequalities that other graph had. It might have more inequalities, because after all, we just ignored one node. Like, if you involve C, maybe you had more inequalities here. But we know at least that there are some that correspond to marginalizing C. Okay, so classically it has some non-trivial inequalities, but we still have to prove that they can be quantumly violated. So what we do is we do the same thing in the quantum case. So now I put yellow to represent that these are quantum systems and not just classical random variables. And marginalizing C again, this could be a problem, right? Because what we want to violate this quantum classical gap is to establish an entangled system between A and B. Because in the instrumental scenario, what we had was like a latent between A and B. And to violate the node, to violate the inequality, you need an entangled system between A and B. But here, since C is classical, it could maybe kill the entanglement between A and B. However, it doesn't, because you can use entanglement swapping, or like the teleportation protocol here. And if you use a teleportation protocol here, so that C teleports this quantum state between A and C to a quantum state between A and B, you can get the quantum version of the instrumental scenario. And this shows that not only you had an inequality in the classical case, but it also can be violated in the quantum case. So indeed here, I have some inequalities, and there's at least one point that is violating one inequality if you go to the set of probability distributions that are compatible when you switch the latents to quantum nodes. All right, so with that, we could prove that the first DAG does have a quantum classical gap, and that's something that we didn't know before the winter school. I showed you this for one specific trick that was like marginalizing out one node, pretending it is latent. But there are a lot of other tricks, like we also condition on our node, or like fix it to a point distribution, or saw what happened when two nodes had exactly the same value. So with using those tricks, we could actually show quantum classical gaps to a lot of DAGs, not just the one that I showed you, and indeed a lot of DAGs. Doing this with our code, this number 331 is the number of total number of equivalence classes, like it doesn't matter, but of equivalence classes of DAGs with four visibles, like Bell. Bell has four visibles, A, B, S, T. And out of those, we could show quantum classical gaps, like just using those tricks, for 284. So it's like the majority of DAGs up to four visibles, they have quantum classical gaps. And yeah, at least to me, that was surprising. Like, I wasn't expecting that to be true. Yeah, so that's it. Now I'm going to summarize. So first, some take-home messages. studying causal inference is important, both for classical data analysis, where it was born, and also for quantum foundations, because Bell's theorem can be seen in that light. And finding new quantum classical gaps can be important as potentially new resources and also potentially better fundamental understanding. And our results were tricks that prove that a QC gap in a DAG G can be implied from a QC gap in another DAG G prime. And then using these tricks, we could prove quantum classical gaps for a large number of causal structures. But then objection you could make is that our tricks, like they just, like an objection to this second point, is that those tricks, they just prove quantum classical gaps from older things that we knew, right? We don't have an actual new technique to prove quantum classical gaps. So something that we have to do is to discuss a criteria to determine like which, if any, are genuinely new in some sense, because the proof technique, kind of all of them rely on Bell, because the ones that are already known, their quantum classical gap can also be shown if you kind of rely on Bell using those types of tricks. But maybe even if the proof technique relies on Bell, some of them might be new resources in a resource theoretic perspective. But it's still a question like how to prove a new quantum classical gap without relying on previously known gaps. This is probably what's going to teach us more about fundamentally, I don't know, what is quintessentially quantum. And yeah, we also, another future direction is maybe try to prove new tricks or maybe new ways to say that that definitely does not have a QC gap. And yeah, that's it.
So Clifford surrogates don't give you a quantum advantage, but I guess I would have thought that you could make a Bell violation, like you can make a Bell pair. Is there a reason that that doesn't have the Bell theorem violating entanglement, that something that is more quantum does?
Okay, you're saying that Clifford circuits, they are in the...
See, I guess I was thinking like Clifford circuits you can simulate classically.
Yeah.
So I figure they're classical in some essential way.
Yeah.
But I would have thought that they could do something that violates Bell's theorem, but...
I think they don't.
They can't?
Yeah, I think they can't because it's, I say that like because Pekinsky theory that I showed you before definitely can't violate Bell's inequalities, and in some sense it's very close to the stabilizer sub theory.
Makes sense. Thank you.
My question is there any possibility that this QC gap non increasing function will make you lose a quantum classical gap?
Yes. So let me go back. Here. Yeah, so you're making a QC. The idea is that we have some set of QC gap non increasing transformations that we prove. And then we have a DAG that we don't know whether it has a QC gap or not. And we're going to apply a lot of those tricks. Like the trick is just the QC gap non increasing transformation. We're going to apply a lot of those tricks and see if any of them gets you to some DAG where we know there's a QC gap. Maybe you get to a DAG where there is no QC gap. And that means that this was not interesting at all. Like this is not wrong, but just doesn't let you imply a QC gap in the original one. And this might not mean that the original one does not have a QC gap. Maybe it's just that this trick didn't work.
And do we know any fundamental graphs other than the three you mentioned that has QC gap?
Actually, even the three mentioned, like they're not fundamental in the sense of the proof technique, because both the triangle and the instrumental, here they were just examples of QC gaps that were known before. But their QC gaps can also be proven relying on Bell.
Oh, so you can connect these two to Bell?
Yes, using those tricks. So far we don't know for sure any new, like genuinely new QC gap apart from Bell.
Yeah, so when you show that which is among 130 or so graphs of four variables, we show that there are like a lot of them to be shown to have QC gaps. Do you have any idea what's happening to the remaining graph? Are they, you think they might not have QC gap, or it's just that your personal methodology doesn't work for them?
Yeah, we don't know. Maybe they all have QC gaps. Maybe the other ones are boring and don't have QC gaps. We don't know.
Okay. One last question. When you do the transformation, do you require that the new graph that you get have the exact same probability distributions, like possible probability distributions over, or do you just require that it has like quantitatively the same gap?
Yeah, good question. Okay, so what do you require in principle, like by those QC gap no increasing transformation? It's just that the gap is no increasing. So you could have like the classical set enlarging if the con set also enlarges.
Okay.
But what we actually have in all those R tricks is that it kind of keeps the same. This is like just in principle, but in R tricks, like here it kept the same, like you had a real, like one-to-one relation between those things. I wouldn't say the same probability distributions, because here you have four visibles and here you have three. But like if you marginalize one, then it's the same.
Okay, cool. That's fine.